Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming this afternoon. And it's my pleasure to introduce Alfonso Bratgay, the governor of the Central Bank of Argentina. Alfonso and I have known each other for a little while. Since when I was chairman of the Financial Services Authority, we had a professional relationship, so to speak, as co-banking supervisors, and of course there are British banks active in Buenos Aires, and there was one Argentine bank in London, though since the crisis it is not taking deposits here any longer. Alfonso was educated at the Católica University in Argentina and then at Penn in the US, and spent much of his career before joining the central bank in JP Morgan. And at the time of the crisis and the immediate post-crisis, there was a lot of concern about who the Argentine government would find to take on what might be politely described as something of a poison chalice of running the central bank. But they were very fortunate, in my view, to find Alfonso to do it. What this says about his own psychological makeup, anyone who would move voluntarily from JP Morgan to the Argentine Central Bank, perhaps a psychoanalyst would be necessary to elucidate that. The circumstances, of course, are very difficult, and I would say that he has one of those impossible jobs, very much in the category of Paul Bremer in Iraq or Kevin Keegan at Manchester City. And so they're people for whom I have a lot of immediate empathy, or at least I did for a while with Kevin Keegan, but I no longer can bring myself to do that. But it's a great problem that he is wrestling with. I was down in Buenos Aires myself about 3 weeks ago, invited by the British ambassador there, Robin Christopher, who's with us today, and also by the Center for Financial Stability in Argentina, a small think tank interested in issues of financial stability, how to regulate a financial system. And I was down there and speaking to them, but I took the opportunity of calling on Alfonso and suggested to him in passing in his office on Reconquista that if he happened to be passing through London, he might like to come and talk to the school. And amazingly, he said instantly, yes, I would love to come. And so here he is, and we're greatly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Howard. Thank you, all of you, for coming over. I hear that you're in the middle of the exam season, and so, you know, Howard was doing a lot of expectations management with me. He was telling me that, you know, no one would show up, so I'm very impressed that, in fact, we have a full house. And we really appreciate that, not just because we are at the LSE, but also because, you know, coming from our side, it's very important for us to have a stage, you know, a privileged stage like the LSE, with privileged students like you are, and to use this stage to make some sense about what we're doing and explain to the world what we haven't been very good at least up until now, in terms of explaining our side of the story, why things went the way they went, and what are we trying to do to pick up the pieces and to go back to normality, because at the end of the day, this is what, if I may, central bank is all about. You know, the best you know, indication of central bank success is when people don't actually notice that you're around. I mean, going back to the football, you know, arena, it's like being a good referee. You know, when the referee is not doing his job, you know, both the home team and the opposite team are going to be very angry at him. When the referee is, you know, goes unnoticed, this is a sign that he's doing his job appropriately, and that's what we're trying to do at the central bank. You know, we're just all we want to do is go back to normality, go unnoticed, and do the things that, you know, central banks usually do, just that, you know, in a different country and in a different way. My plan is to talk a little bit about, you know, the policy challenges. I thought that since we were having mostly a student audience, and since it wasn't long ago since I was on that side of the room, I thought it would be good for this audience to at least understand, you know, the Argentina experience from the point of view of a practitioner, from the point of view of a policymaker, which is something you might eventually consider coming from the LSE and from such a privileged institution. So I won't go into, you know, how great the GDP numbers are and, you know, how good this or that thing is. I just want to flash out what are the policy challenges we're going through. Mostly focused on the central bank, obviously. The many things that the central bank is not responsible for in Argentina, those I won't talk about. But I do want to, you know, make a few points in general about what it is to be a policymaker in what's called the emerging market world. Because it's a different ballgame from, you know, being a policymaker elsewhere, because there are lots of things that, you know, elsewhere you would take for granted, and that in emerging markets you don't have. And there are lots of things that you do have in emerging markets where, you know, you don't dream of having in the developed world. You know, for emerging markets in general, the challenge is even, you know, larger when you think that, you know, first of all, we are a small drop in a large ocean. You know, emerging markets, by definition, with a few exceptions, but in most cases are very small places where, you know, big things developing elsewhere can, you know, hit you really hard. So in the emerging market world, the things like, you know, external shocks, and we're looking at the way the markets are behaving today, the last 3 or 4 days, these external shocks do have an important bearing on not just the emerging market economies, but in particular emerging market policy making. And that's one thing you've got to take into account, just as we have to take into account the fact that, whether we like it or not, the world is globalized, and therefore the rules of the game are different than if you were not in a globalized world. In our case, particularly in Latin America, there's an additional element, which is because of the social situation, because of a poor distribution of income, because of high poverty levels, social demands are quite high. And that obviously transpires throughout the political system. And the central bank is not an island. The central bank is part of that, you know, society, and therefore these are things that need to be taken into account. In my country in particular, where poverty levels today are at around 40%, that means about 40% of the population does not earn enough money to cover for basic needs. In a country where, you know, usually that number never went, you know, beyond 10%. This is a massive regime shift, if you will, and something that, you know, will restrict whatever you do on your policy side. If on top of that you look at, you know, the results of policy making over the last decades and years, you know, there's been a lot written and said about the 90s in Latin America. However you cut it and slice it, the one thing we know about the experience of the 90s is that growth was rather subpar. This was true in the case of Argentina, but by and large for Latin America, growth rates in the 90s were actually lower than what they had been, not in the lost decades of the 70s or of the 80s, but certainly before the 80s. It looked as if, you know, Latin America was the place to be in, but at the end of the day, growth was not as sexy as, you know, the newspaper headlines had been telling you all along throughout the 90s. In a way, the policy making of the 90s was disappointing. And not just growth was lacking, if you will, but as I said before, the distribution of income, the poverty level, the social variables were also on the way down rather than on the way up. And on top of that, in our particular case in Argentina, that experience ended up, as you know, not just in tears, but with significant economic and social costs in what's been probably one of the most severe, and I look at you, Charles, one of the most severe financial crises you've ever seen, not just in emerging markets, but elsewhere. So this is basically the challenge. We are in a globalized world. We've got to take as many shocks as they come. We've got to be, you know, very sensitive to social demands. We've got a bad track record on our back, and we are dealing to normalize a country that has gone through one of the most severe financial crises you can think of. So how on earth do you do that? I don't think it's as bad as Howard was referring to in his introduction. But there are a few things you've actually got to do even before you get started. First thing is that, you know, from a macro point of view, you've got so many constraints, you've got so many challenges, that you can't quite afford not to have as many economic policy instruments as you can have. And this was, in fact, one of the problems we had during the 90s. We decided it was a great idea just to let go monetary policy, just for the sake of it. I mean, there was an idea, as you know, of trickling down, not just, you know, internally. You know, you got growth, and that growth would trickle down to the rest of the population. But also policy-wise, you know, you had Greenspan, and let that trickle down to the rest of the world, and therefore get rid of your monetary policy because, rightly so, you were not so good at it for many, many decades. But our challenge right now is, as I said before, to recover as many policy instruments as we can, and to be, you know, courageous and brave enough to actually try to use these instruments. You know, in the past, we've rather either abused of these instruments or, you know, renounced to them altogether. And the challenge this time around is to get them in the right dose and to do it, you know, in the right fashion. Forgetting about, you know, magic, as I said before, focusing on, you know, a step-by-step and day-by-day effort. So, you know, recovering as many policy instruments as you can. For that, of course, there's a pre-necessity, if you will, without which you can't actually have the instruments that you want to have, which is credibility. And one of the reasons why people like Greenspan, people like Mervyn King, have such an easy job at the end of the day is because they build the credibility along the decades, along the years. And credibility in policy making means more rather than less instruments, because you've got, you know, more levers to operate on, and the levers you operate on are a lot more powerful than otherwise. Now, credibility, you know, it's a long-run effort. It's something you've got to work on a daily basis. It can, you know, slip away very quickly, and it's something that, you know, as I say, we are at the moment trying to put together, and we are basically at the central bank in that effort, as I said before, of turning the central bank into a central bank. Now, with that intro, let me get into the slideshow. I'll go rather fast to make sure we allow for as many questions as needed. You know, I do need to start with a very, you know, basic chart of inflation and GDP growth, because, you know, this is basically what policy management is all about at the end of the day. What you can see there is the blue bars are real GDP numbers, and the red line is basically the inflation. And, you know, before we get into what's going on right now, which is what I call here the sunny side of the business side, let's take a look at what was going on, you know, before the actual crisis, according to the newspapers. The crisis, of course, started off back in 1998 with the beginning of the Russian problem and the fallout effect it had on Argentina. If you bother to count how many of those, you know, blue bars are pointing south in this chart, you've got 16 of those. in a row. So that means a recession of 16 quarters in a row to not at 8. So most of that period, inflation was actually non-existent. We had deflation, which is one of the issues central bankers should always be trying to avoid. For some reason, you know, not too many people thought that despite 16 quarters in a row of recession, the system needed to be fixed. So it took so long for policymakers to realize that, that as always happens with fixed exchange rates, when the defect came, it was rather, you know, harmful, as you can see. So once you get out of the bag, you get an acceleration in the intensity of the recession. Inflation goes up, so everything goes against you. Basically, the economy, you know, falls even more rapidly. Inflation goes up. Everyone is blamed at. After a while, when things settle down, you get pretty much the opposite, which is where we are right now. GDP growth rates of around, you know, 10%, double digits or so, and inflation rates that are currently around 3%. You know, Rudy Dornbusch used to say, you know, when he talked about fixed exchange rates, and I'll say this and move on, I don't want to talk much about the past, but he had a great definition of fixed exchange rates. He said, you know, they go through three different phases or stages. In the first stage, everything works beautifully well. I mean, you fix the currency, you give certainty to, you know, consumers, households, and businessmen. You know, you fix the inflation problem, the economy goes up dramatically, so you've got low inflation, you know, high GDP growth, you know, high votes for whoever's in power, and you get to the point where you ask yourselves, you know, why on earth didn't I think about this before? It was such an easy thing to do. That is the first stage. In the second stage, you start getting into some trouble, but you're still with a hangover of the first stage. Are you not allowing yourself to actually realize that this might not last forever? And you start having some competitiveness problems, you know, some of the tradable sectors start having some issues, but you know, this is too good anyway, so we won't get into any particular problem. Now the third stage, of course, the problems have gone too far, and you've got too far into that particular effort, such that it's too costly to get out of it. And for a politician, that's never a good trade-off, because you get a lot of cost in the short run and an eventual benefit in the very long run. And that's why usually pegs, you know, end the way they do. And in our particular case, even more so, because not only did we have a peg, but we had a currency board on top of it. Now, you can flip Rudy Dornbusch's picture as if you were looking at it in a mirror. And build up your own stages of a DPEG, if you will. In the first stage, everything goes wrong. You know, GDP collapses, inflation skyrockets. You know, presidents get, you know, voted out, if there's a vote. Sometimes it's not even a vote. And you get to the point where people ask themselves, why on earth did we get out? Wasn't it much better than what it was? That's kind of the first stage. In the second stage, everyone is still shaken up by, you know, how bad the collapse was and the defect was. And despite the fact that you start seeing some, you know, good indications that the economy is settling down and some sectors are doing well, you don't believe in it. You know, the skeptics basically cover the floor because, you know, the defect was so bad. This is the second stage. In the third stage, finally, you've got, you know, things working your way, and you've got this kind of virtuous cycle we're at right now. From a policy-making point of view, our main challenge here is to make sure that we keep this ball rolling. And how can we do that? Well, you know, there are many things we can do, but in a nutshell, this is the way we can explain what's going on right now in Argentina as far as policy-making is concerned. We're in a situation where, as we claim here, we might be getting to the right policy mix. Meaning, fiscal policy is quite tight, monetary policy therefore can afford to be on the loose side, and on top of that, in the background, you've got a currency that is a lot more competitive than it used to be, and it's very, very competitive from our historical model. So basically, your primary surplus today is about 4 points of GDP larger than what it was on average during the 90s. Real interest rates are, on average, 3 points lower than what they were during the 90s. But when you look at them right now, they're probably 10 points lower than what they were on average during the 90s. And the currency is twice as competitive as it used to be during the 90s. You look around the world, you don't have too many places where there's this balance between monetary and fiscal policy, and where the currency is helping out the way it is in Argentina. Why is this important? Because when you look at other experiences, countries undergoing crises that are similar to the one Argentina went through, a stylized fact of the aftermath of that crisis is a very rapid appreciation of the currency. You know, countries are more sort of inclined to let the competitive advantage go rather soon. And once they do that, you know, they could, in fact, run into trouble. In the case of Argentina, the currency has remained competitive because, among other reasons, at the central bank, we decided not to take hold of the easy, you know, vehicle of letting the currency appreciate to come down on inflation. Two more charts on the macro, and then we'll go straight into the challenges. As you know, as I told you, you know, the business cycle is working on our side. But the very good news about it is that finally investment is picking up. And as I said in the introduction, you know, when you look at investment in Latin America and elsewhere, you don't need to look just at fixed investment. Fixed investment obviously is part of the story. As you can see there, you know, the blue line is telling you that, you know, we're getting into investment growth rates around 50% per annum. Of course, you know, the capital stock has been, you know, partially depleted during the crisis, and this is what the bars are showing. You need to grow, you need to have large investment growth rates before you can get back to the stock you had earlier, which will, you know, finance growth going forward. But that thing is actually coming up. You know, net investment is finally positive after 3 years, 2 years and a half rather, of being on the negative side. And the other side of capital that sometimes goes, you know, disregarded is human capital. As I said, for Latin America, this is a very, very particular issue. If we went back in this chart, what this chart will show you is every time we have a crisis, we start off with an actual, you know, with a higher level, higher poverty level than in the previous crisis. And this human capital deterioration, it's showing not just through the macro figures in America, in Latin America and in Argentina, but throughout most of the figures that you can look at. And this obviously means less growth capacity going forward. The good news, as this chart is showing you, is that both employment is going up and the poverty levels are coming down, thanks to the impressive growth rates without inflation. Now let's move on to the challenges, first for monetary policy. And as I said before, you know, reputation is not necessarily an asset for, you know, central banks like ours. Yeah, when you're in the middle of a crisis, there's an issue of division of labor between the central bank and the rest of the public agencies. I'll just give you two examples which serve as anecdotal evidence of, you know, how acute our crisis was. As you know, at the end of 2001, there was a deposit freeze. The deposit freeze was decided by the government at the time, by decree. Of course, if you're a central bank operating in a financial system whose, you know, deposits are frozen, there's not much room for maneuver that you have. But since this was actually created by a decree, there's nothing you can do about it, unless, you know, the government actually turns around that decree. And that's something that happened, in fact, in early 2003. We worked together with the Ministry of Finance to make that happen. We lifted all the restrictions that we had. And, you know, today, all deposits are free. A year and a half ago, about 80% of the deposits in the financial system had some sort of restriction. Another good example of this is, you know, throughout the crisis, because of the lack of policy tools, many provincial governments decided to start issuing their own bonds. I never quite called them currencies because, you know, that's actually unconstitutional. We like to think ourselves at some point as, you know, not having competitors yet. But the truth of the matter was that, you know, many of these provincial bonds, as many as 13, were actually used as a means of exchange and therefore pretty much like currencies throughout the country. Again, not much you can do as a central bank, but this was another area where we sat down together with the Ministry of Finance. We found a way of solving the riddle, and as of today, none of those currencies or, you know, provincial bonds are actually in circulation. We took away roughly 7.5 billion pesos worth of these provincial bonds, which at the time of the crisis represented about 30% of the monetary base. But as far as commercial banks are concerned, I'll show you a few charts, but basically what's going on is that there still is a significant counterparty risk, meaning, you know, the lack of credit is, you know, pretty much cutting through the whole system. Banks do not lend out to the private sector, they're starting to do that, but they still have problems with, you know, lending out to themselves. You know, credit lines are not particularly ample, and this creates a significant problem for monetary policy in the sense that the obvious conduct and the obvious transmission mechanism for monetary policy is not working properly. So there are many things that we are trying to do to make sure that we lessen that counterparty risk. Economic environment, basically the usual stuff for central bankers in terms of identifying money demand. But on top of that, we've got an exogenous shrinkage of our balance sheet, which I'll explain in a minute. And as far as the central bank is concerned, as I mentioned before, you know, this problem of lack of instruments and lack of practice as well, because for over 10 years, the central bank was just a teller machine. You've got dollars on one, you know, cashier, you issue pesos on the other one, or the other way around, depending on the cycle. But that was pretty much what the central bank was meant to do. Our challenge now is to, you know, a little bit more ambitious, to turn the central bank into a central bank. So how are we going to do that? Well, certainly history, as I said before, is not on our side. The Argentine Central Bank has been around for almost 70 years. It was founded in 1935. And you can see, you know, this is the histogram of inflation in Argentina. If you look at those episodes or instances where inflation was higher than 10%, that was about, you know, two-thirds of the time, pretty much. And there was about, you know, 7% of the time where, you know, the inflation was actually deflation. So when you look at these, you know, red bars, and you could even argue that this green bar should also be a red bar, if we're shooting for civilized inflation levels. What you can see is, when you look at the history of our central bank, is that most of the times the central bank was not doing its job, because it was either producing very high inflation or deflation. The two things this referee was meant to avoid, the two mistakes a central bank is always meant to avoid. Last year, as you know, our inflation rate was 3.7%, so we got in the right bucket, if you will. I'll talk about that later on. It was, in fact, the first time ever inflation was in this bucket with a floating regime. So that's, you know, that's a good starting point, but of course there's a lot more to be done before we can call it a day. Let me... Let me just say two words on this one. You know, these are the sources of money creation. I was talking about a shrinking balance sheet, and this is, you know, the way of explaining it. You know, the blue bars, you know, belong to 2002. This was when the economy was not yet finding a solid footing. It was still, you know, living through the aftershocks of the big crisis. At that time, the financial sector needed a lot of help, and the central bank was pumping a lot of money into the financial sector through rediscounts to, you know, such that banks could finance the deposit drainage that they were having. At that time, the government was running a deficit, and therefore, you know, the central bank was the only, it was not just, you know, the lender of last resort, but it was also the lender of first resort and the actual, you know, the only lender. And it was drawing upon some of the central bank resources. These two things flipped around on the following years, 2003 and 2004. The financial sector now is bringing pesos back because they've got enough liquidity to do so. And the government, as we said before, running a surplus, is paying down some of those debts. So basically, you know, what we have is a situation where if we were not to do anything, our balance sheet would start shrinking without, you know, us having anything to do with it. There's a third element here, which is, you know, our own central bank bills, which we created in the middle of the crisis to provide the market with an interest rate benchmark. And, you know, until we develop that market, this will obviously become an absorption mechanism until we find that we've gotten to the right outstanding balance. And that's actually what's been going on so far. So as you can see, in, you know, 2002, money was going one way, in 2003 and 2004, it's going the other way around. Our main way to add liquidity into the system is through the external sector, and that's why we intervene in the market as disciplined as we can, as we can show in this chart. Very quickly, what this chart is doing is showing you the traded volumes in the FX market. We've gone all the way up from 40 million back in early 2003, it was much less than that in 2002. Two numbers that are close to 200 million, still a small market, but a much bigger one than it used to be. And, you know, the pale blue area here shows you our FX interventions. As you can tell by the chart, up until September of last year, we've got to admit that our interventions were pretty much all over the place. You know, we had peaks of whatever, 130, and then nothing in the following day, and so on. Now what we're doing is we're trying to go in steps, and we're trying to, you know, stick to one amount once we get there. And this is kind of the flip side of a monetary program. The central bank bills, what they're doing now is they're costing us a lot less than they used to. Around mid-2002, we were paying about 130% on average on those bills. Now we're paying a bit less than 10% on average. Back then, you know, the longest tenor for that bid was 6 months. Now we go as far as 3 years. And as you can see, the stock has been moving up quite nicely throughout the last quarters. Now, I said we want to turn the central bank into a central bank. And that in itself is a monumental task. We can use the example of others. And what we're trying to do in using that example is basically move on towards an inflation targeting regime. And the first place to stop at when you're moving towards an inflation targeting regime is, you know, your credibility building effort or exercise. And what we're doing in that regard is, you know, since June of last year, we put together a monetary program that is predicated on, as we say, a quantitative target, you know, the amount of money that we will, you know, pump into the system. And we've actually accomplished that program ever since. We've been meeting the targets for about 11 months now. These are the targets that we've brought into the rest of the year. But this is really the flip side. I mean, these numbers come off from our inflation targets. And all we do with those quantitative targets is try to estimate the money demand, which is obviously not an easy thing. Where are we going to in the next few years? Here are the inflation targets we have agreed with the IMF. We've got a band of 7 to 11% in 2004, 5 to 8% in 2005, 4 to 7% in 2006, and yet inflation is already running around 3%. It's almost as if, you know, we're there, but we can't fool ourselves. We know it would be premature to call it a day. Not only that, we also know that there's still a few price adjustments that are in the pipeline, particularly those price adjustments, or if you will, lagged price adjustments, relative price adjustments, some of them led by the market, some others led by the government in, you know, their price setting capability, particularly in the public services sector, but not the only one. Taxes also had a lot to do with that. So that was the reason why we thought, okay, we ended up at 3.7% in 2003. We had a higher target for 2004 because we are providing for these one-off price increases. Our challenge is to make sure that we can accommodate for those increases in a way that we are not compromising, you know, the inflation in the long run. And that's our main challenge for this year. Now, how about challenges for banking policy? Very rapidly throughout this. Lack of resources, I'll explain, outdated rules, risk aversion and asymmetric information, we can talk about that in the Q&A session. Balance sheet mismatches, banks have a lot of exposure to things they can't actually, you know, get rid of. All banks are on the same side of the trade, they've got a lot of exposure to the public sector, because in places they've got a lot of exposure to inflation, index, and bonds, and that, you know, makes them vulnerable to increasing yield rates. They've got, you know, duration mismatch. They're getting CDs at very short tenors, like 30 days, and, you know, the demand for credit starts only at 6 months, so they've got this, you know, mismatch there as well, currency mismatches and whatnot. Solvent debt restructuring is a key issue because, you know, banks, about 50% of banks' assets are actually, you know, government bonds or loans to the public sector. And just as we do, banks also lack instruments and practice. You know, banks have not been very good at lending to the private sector, for instance, over the last 15 years. Maybe, you know, we can make that 30 years, and I think we're going to be mistaken. And because of, you know, the many issues regarding risk aversion and so on, there are not too many instruments around for banks to make, you know, money out of them. So our main challenge there is to guide them to fix themselves. Basically the idea of, you know, showing them the way and setting the right set of incentives and the right timetable such that banks are able to do that. And I'll explain briefly. And this will take, you know, the very last part of my presentation. I think this is a very important table. I'm not sure you can, at the back, you can actually, you know, spot these numbers. But I'll read the important ones for you. What we're doing here is we're listing countries that have gone through, you know, significant financial crises in the emerging market world since the Mexican crisis in 1994-95. And what we're trying to do is, in the first two columns, what we're doing is we're coming up with a measure of the intensity of the crisis. And when it comes to banks, there are two ways you can look at that intensity. One is liquidity, and the best way of doing that is looking at deposits. The other is solvency, and there's no way around but to look at net worth. You can look at the different experiences, but if you take the average of your typical emerging market financial crisis during the 90s, you had a situation where deposits fell about 20% in real terms, and net worth for the financial system pretty much the same thing. So this was a situation where, you know, about one-fifth of the bank's wealth disappeared in the crisis, and about one-fifth of deposits fled the system. Now, in our case, as you probably know, it was twice as bad. Real deposits fell like 42%, and the net worth drop was around 37%. So our first conclusion here, the intensity of the crisis we're dealing with is on average twice as large as your typical prices during the 90s. And we had quite a few big ones, as you can see up there. Now, here's the magnitude of the problem. These two columns will tell us, you know, what resources do we have at hand to deal with the problem. And the problem usually, after a crisis, has two stages. First, stop the bleeding. Secondly, recapitalize the banking system. For recapitalizing the banking system, you need to get checks from somewhere. And, you know, usually in these crises, you get the checks both from the public sector in the country in place. You know, you get the public sector, the government, you know, putting money into the banks to prop them up, to the tune of around 31% of GDP on average. Of course, you've got larger numbers there, particularly in Asia. If you go back to the 80s, in the case of Chile, in the early 80s, this number was close to 100% of GDP. That was the fiscal cost of the banking crisis. And then you usually get some help from the international financial institutions. Just for the sake of comparison, you know, what we're doing is we're looking at the money that these countries got in the aftermath of the crisis, only from the IMF. They could have gotten some money from the World Bank, IDB, other places. For instance, in the case of Mexico, they got $10.7 billion from the IMF, but they got an overall check of around $50 billion, because as you know, the US was also contributing, and some other countries, some other ICs were contributing. The point is that on average, you know, these countries got $6.2 billion from the IMF. In our case, the IMF got from us about $1 billion. So the checks were certainly going the wrong way, as far as we are concerned. And if you look at, you know, the net payments to the ICs that Argentina has made in 2002 and 2003, we're getting close to $6.5 billion. So twice as bad as crisis, very little resources, you know, certainly negative resources from the IFIs, and about one third coming from the public sector, one third of what other places have on average. So it's certainly quite a challenging, you know, situation. Now, what was our story? Our story was, you know, we haven't got money, but we've got time. Time is money, and therefore we've got to use it wisely. I remember Ken Roberts. I don't know if he's been in LSU, but he was the chief economist for the IMF. In the Dubai IMF meeting last September, Ken Roberts made a point of, he said, you know, he was talking about the global recovery, and he said, well, this is the best recovery money can buy. And he was obviously referring to the massive amount of stimulus that the economy was getting from the monetary side and from the fiscal side, particularly in the US, and we're seeing the unwinding of that right now, but elsewhere as well. Now, I used Ken's formula to explain what we're doing in Argentina with the banking system. And as far as we are concerned, this is the best bank restructuring no money can buy. This is actually what we're trying to do. And, you know, how do we actually do that? You know, we set the targets in a way that are affordable for banks. This is the capital adequacy ratio that we have for banks. This is what we had prior to the crisis. This is what happened, you know, throughout the crisis. And this is kind of the upward sloping challenge that we enforce on banks going forward. This is the pace at which you will have to recapitalize yourselves during the next few years. And of course, the mistake we could be making here is, well, we could be either too lenient, and in that case, we have less capital than we could have had otherwise, or we're too strict, in which case we end up having less banks than we could have had otherwise. So this is obviously a balancing act. It's about, you know, getting the right sticks and carrots and the right incentives. Of course, since there's no official money coming in, this recapitalization will have to happen through either retained earnings or, you know, capital additions from existing or prospective banks. And a lot of that is happening already. When you look at the capital base of the financial system right now, about one fourth of the net worth of the financial system
was actually injected after the crisis. So shareholders are actually putting some money at work to some extent to meet up the increasing requirements we are asking them to meet. In terms of what's going on with loans and deposits, this is actually a rather good chart. You get the sense here, this is the crisis we had in 1995, the so-called Tequila crisis, which had a significant aftershock and reverberation in Argentina. That was a crisis where deposits were falling more rapidly than loans. That was your typical crisis. Now, this was the crisis in its nature. It was a lot more similar to the crisis you had in Asia, in Turkey, and so on. But the one we had later on. The one we had later on was basically driven by not a deposit run. Eventually, we did have a deposit run. But more so, a creditor run. Banks were actually getting out of those loans. And because we didn't have monetary policy, that created a massive credit crunch, which hit the economy. And once it hit the economy, it was obvious that the Fed couldn't last. And once that was obvious, then you did have the deposit run. So it was a bit different in that regard. It's also a bit different on its way out, particularly when it comes to loans. We're now finally, after a little bit over 2 years since the explosion of the crisis, if you will, we're back in black in terms of loan growth. It took 2 years to get back there. This is actually rather quick. When you look at other places, bank credit to the private sector took ages to recover. In the case of Mexico, for instance, they're still running on credit levels that are actually lower than what they had prior to the crisis. But this is probably one of the best pieces of news for the financial system. Banks are finally starting to lend again. That is actually helping them to turn the monies around as far as profitability is concerned. You look at, in 2002, the return on assets was minus 9%, a massive loss. In the first half of 2003, they were losing about 5% of their assets on an annual basis. This turned around in the second half of last year, and as I said before, we're quite close to break even. The first quarter of this year is going to be slightly negative, but the trend is certainly on the way up. And when it comes to loans to the private sector, we've seen a little bit of that already. But this, I think, is a good chart to look at. Credit to the private sector right now is only about 7% of GDP. That's a rather low figure. It used to be 23% of GDP. And even that is not that ambitious. You look at Brazil right now, Brazil is around 30% of GDP. Chile is probably 60%, and other countries are, of course, much larger than that. So here's a measure of the upside potential that you have if everyone in the public sector does their homework, and if the private sector is up to the test. Only moving up a few steps would mean a massive increase in volume, and therefore plenty of opportunities for banks to make money out of it and therefore recapitalize themselves. Now, somewhere along the presentation, I made the point that we had to change the rules. The rules of the game. Most of the rules were constructed around one certainty, that the peso was going to be equal to $1 forever until the end of times. And the whole framework and the whole regulatory framework of the banking system was built around that revealed truth, if you will. There were many other things going on, and this chart I think is quite interesting because it gives you a flavor of how bad regulations, and how I'm sure you agree with this, bad regulations can do a lot of harm, even if you don't notice it for long enough until it actually binds on you. We had, during the 90s, we had a set of capital rules that decided that the best player the best borrower one could have was the public sector. Therefore, if you have 1 peso worth of capital, although we have this Basel Plus type of arrangement where banks were required to have a lot of capital, the truth of the matter was that there were a few exceptions, such that with 1 peso worth of capital, you could lend as much as 25 pesos to the public sector, not just the federal public sector, but the provincial governments as well, as opposed to less than 9 pesos to large firms, about 7 pesos to small and medium-sized companies, and about 5 pesos, not more than 5 pesos, to individuals and households. The irony, as you might have guessed already, is that reality showed that this table had to be flipped. You know, individuals were the best payers, small and medium-sized companies came next. The large firms took advantage of, you know, the sovereign default in many cases, and the sovereign already. So basically, one very commonsensical thing we did back in early 2003 was put everyone on the same level playing field. We're not going to decide who's more, worthy to receive loans. Let the banks do that for themselves. And all we're going to say is if you've got 1 peso worth of capital, you know, you choose who you're going to lend 12.5 pesos. But we're not going to get into that. So that means that, you know, if you go through the math, banks have a potential of 150% larger potential to lend to individuals than they had during the 90s, 80% for small and medium-sized companies and so on. As you can see, we're very strict when it comes to, you know, lending to the public sector. We've got strict limits there, and that's, you know, basically because of what happened and because of the inheritance. Let me just finish up with this chart. What this chart is showing is what loans are doing to, particularly the loans that, the short-run loans, the ones that are reacting more rapidly to the economic environment. As you can imagine, you know, thinking about mortgage loans, it takes, you need to go 15, 20 years out, and you still have these balance mismatches. But when you look at, the loan picture, excluding mortgages and auto loans, you can see that the trend is finally turning around. And in fact, for some particular, chapters of the loan story, you've got growth rates of around 4, 5, 6% per month, which is, in other places, and particularly, I'm sure, Howard, if you had this situation back when you were at FSA, you would have gotten concerned. This is, in our case, exactly what we need. When the stars are aligned, they are aligned for banks to start lending again. As I said before, leverage is very low. Profitability is an issue. If banks are going to remain profitable, they've got to lend. So I'll probably stop there. The whole idea was just to introduce you to the intricacies of policy making, particularly in Argentina, restricting myself to the central bank, with this idea that the central bank has under its wing to care not just about monetary policy, but also banking policy. And the best we can do, as I said before, is to go and notice. The central bank, the way I see it, is a large facilitator. I'm not too sure that word actually exists in English, but if it does, that's what a central bank should do. Make things easy. Do not make things you do not need to do. But basically, eliminate as many risks, as many uncertainties as we can to let bankers do their thing, to let companies and consumers do their thing. If you get the right monetary arrangement and it's available, let's say the inflation targeting regime, you wipe off one of the most costly uncertainties Argentinians have dealt with throughout the years, which is not knowing what inflation is going to do, not just within the next 5 months, but tomorrow. And if you're a medical doctor, and if on top of caring about knowing where the kidney is and how to fix it, you need to go back home and spend 2 hours trying to identify where inflation is going to be
12 months down the road because you don't want your savings to get wiped off. That creates lots of uncertainty. So Argentina has never had a sound currency. It's usually had a currency for transaction, not a currency for savings. Our main task here is to make sure we can get there, the only way of having a proper, sound, unique currency. As far as the banking system is concerned, you know, what we need to do is come up with the right sticks and carrots, let the sticks and the carrots do the job, let banks, you know, take advantage of it and do their own thing. That's basically what we're trying to do in an environment of, you know, lots of constraint, as I said before. The results so far are encouraging. You know, the first year and a half or so is looking quite bright in terms of growth, inflation, and so on. But we must not rest on our laurels. We should not sit on our hands. There's still a long way to go, and that's what we're trying to do. So, you know, I'll stop there. Thank you very much for your patience. I think this covers, you know, at least, you know, what the challenges are. But I'm sure you've got lots of questions you know, about this and maybe about other stuff that I'm, you know, willing to take on. Thank you.
Question here.
Now that Argentina is back to fiduciary standard, to floating or being again, what's going to prevent the past from recurring in the sense of fiscal policy poisoning monetary policy? What's new about the regime that's going to stop what's happened throughout Argentina's past?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think, you know, we've got to go beyond design. To spend more time on practice. You know, for instance, when it comes to credibility or even independence in central bank, a hot topic, particularly in emerging markets. You know, I'm of the opinion that, you know, you're not born independent. You put to earn your independence, particularly in emerging markets. And you might have a beautiful charter, which is what we actually have. If you look at the charter of the central bank, and it is indeed, you know, as some of them said, one of the most independent central banks in the world. You know, I'm not saying that, it's an advantage.
No higher praise.
But anyway, I mean, these guys check on, you know, other charges and stuff. But that's the jure independence. So the factor is a completely different ballgame. As much as, you know, our central bank was legally independent, I happen to be the fourth governor in 1 year. So that obviously, you know, tells you something about, you know, the difficulties in actually earning the credibility that we should be, you know, enjoying if we have the charter as it is. So, you know, when I look forward and I'm trying to ask you a question, I think the main issue here is we need to regain credibility. Without credibility, you don't have instruments of any regard when it comes to economic policy. And we can't quite make the mistake of the past of pretending to not need them, or tying ourselves to someone else who happens to be smarter, but who at the end of the day has got very different, you know, incentives, very different goals than we do. So it's a longer road, but it's a more sustainable road. I'm not saying that just because we're wishing for it, it's going to happen. But the fact that we are, for the first time in a while, trying to do what a normal country would do is a change in itself. The main challenge, as I said before, is keeping that policy mix to the extent we can, as long as we can. That in itself will require a lot of effort. But rather than shooting for scoring that momentous second goal with Maradona in 1986, I think the task here should be avoid screw-ups. You know? Just avoiding mistakes can get us a long way. You know, we can have those great goals, but then if those great goals are not, you know, followed by the right stuff, it doesn't work in that way.
Okay, well, keep your hands in your pockets if you're talking about scoring goals by Maradona. Yeah, could we have
you always forget about the second goal.
We were in tears at that point. So, man with a tie near the back, which...
Low interest rates in the US have very little to do because, you know, we are
as far as the commercial channel is concerned, yes, solar bee prices were a big help. But that help was actually equally managing to the harm that an ongoing Brazilian economy had represented for Argentina last year. What soya price giveth will see taken. So it's very funny to see how people look at the international environment with a very partialized view of that thing, as if, you know, Brazil is not important to Argentina, but you can take it off the equation. So my point is that Brazil was already, you know, subtracting growth in 2003. It would take a major problem in Brazil to create, you know, more GDP loss in Argentina than it did last year. And it's certainly not a scenario for looking at.
Man with a red shirt will you be behind, and then we'll look at.
I don't have a strong view on that one. I think you can argue both ways. As long as, you know, all we need is someone who's knowledgeable enough to do these things. One, having been in markets myself for a few years, I never cease to be amazed at how short memories are. When you look at the sort of evolution of macroeconomic variables in Argentina, you pick the variable you want and overlay on top of that one the same variable for, say, Korea in 1997-98 or Russia in 1999. It's almost exactly the same thing. Stylized facts are stylized facts. And of course, it was entire issues like, you know, local politics and the initial conditions of the economies, like the first and so on, are very important. But, you know, sensible economics can lead you very far, and therefore it's not necessarily require that particular nationality to do it. I think the fund needs to work harder on the selection process. It's a separate topic. But in terms of whether we have the right or the wrong person, you know, I wouldn't be able to make that appropriate. You know, Argentina was in favor of this nomination, and we were very excited about having him on board, and we wish him well. But the proof, you know, would be really good.
A woman in white. Okay. Much further than, you know, names or a woman in black in front of him.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's an answer. I can show you my resume. No, I think, you know, what I can say is that, the first time I saw the president at the time, the president who offered me a job,
I won't ask if you've met Senora Duhalde, but,
How long did you live in this country before, for example,
my turn ends in September, so...
Oh, good. So, then do you want to be involved with that?
You had a different question.
He thought that was a better one.
The second question was, what are the main, you mentioned just like what you're doing with the
I think what we're seeing is basically a normalization of the business sector. Just as, a fruitful economy is not expected to last forever, you should not expect economies growing at double digits forever, unless your population is growing at double digits. But that's not our case. When we took office, one thing we were very convinced about, I'm not sure about anything, I'm not sure about the solution, but we were very convinced about that we had a significant output gap. Increasingly so, central banks are spending a lot of time trying to identify the holy grail of economic policy for Sinister, this knowing how large their output gap is and what they're saying. But this is a very difficult exercise because we've got no tools, not just to have a good sense of what the size of that output is. As I said before, our condition was that it was too large. This was one of the reasons why we had a big discussion with the IMF at the very beginning of 2003. Because the IMF thought, we were chosen before, one of the ways that this made 60% is value. And the patient being 40%. So the IMF was, is an ongoing thing, but to do something about it. And our response to that was, we didn't know whether it's an ongoing thing or whether the money line is that thing. All we know is that we can't quite go with, a view until we see things happen. So we're going to have a much more open-minded approach. And that wanted us to reduce money supply by around 3% in 4 months. And even if we do that, inflation would be no lower than 30%. Now, at the end of the day, market expansion is close to 30%. bank version was in the US and yeah, it worked out well. And the reason for that was that there was no pricing power in the economy. And the reason for that was also the fact that, you know, as with many other crises in the aftermath, you know, with the recovering economy, you get recovery in the demand for money. And if the financial system is not working properly, then the onus, the burden of that new monetization falls on the central bank. And that was the point we were making. And we were pointing at Japan. Japan at that time had probably been growing at 30%. And yet still by inflation. So these things can happen. So we've always had a view that there was a significant output gap, and that until that output gap was replenished, the economy could grow without creating price pressures, which is basically the way we look at it. Now, we know very well that this will not last forever. Eventually, you know, these things close up. And eventually, you know, businesses will recover price and power. How far off we are, we can't answer that much. But our sense is that, you know, we are, as I said before, getting closer to normalization of the business. In our latest inflation report, we elaborate a bit more on it, with the idea that we do expect to slow into the end of the year, and we would also expect a temporary pickup in inflation. The reasons that are, you know, explained there. But just to give you a sense, what we have in our forecast is GDP growth at, you know, at the fourth quarter of this year, we're forecasting GDP growth up 5.5% over a year ago. Right now the numbers are more like, you know, 11% over a year ago. Because of that, once, you know, 2004 is over, and you take the average, the average would still be about 8%. In fact, you know, something like the fund, because, you know, you're going to talk badly about the fund. There's one area where you can do that. You know, they still have a forecast of 5.5% for this year. The only way you can get that is by having a rather intense recession in the second half of the year. I don't see how we can get that, and that's certainly not our opinion. No, no, I think we're on third phase. And the time is the third phase, you know, lasting.
We need to finish it by about 3:30, I'm afraid. So let's take one more question here.
For what you say, it seems to me that the ideas that were very popular in the 1990s about international currency.
Towards fighting inflation. We got that, and she didn't got that in our view. one colleague in Brazil, a colleague in Peru, a colleague in Mexico, and a colleague pretty much everywhere. Because what is the main lesson that we can take from our experiences? It takes a lot more than exploits on an army force. It takes a whole set of policies for this coordination to work. And it would be a mistake to think that just because you fight your constituency, the same currency your neighbor has had its constituency, that in itself would create coordination in Christ. As I said before, it's a lot more ambitious, but it's an only way we can actually fight for it.
Alfonso, thank you very much. I'm sorry we ought to wind up. I'm afraid we do have to wind up now. So thank you very much for coming. We're enormously grateful to you for your presentation, for answering so many questions. We hope that you succeed in stabilizing and normalizing, because we've suffered here in a reduction of the flow of students from Argentina as a result of the crisis, which has been bad for our football team, and our tango team is looking pretty slim too. So we very much wish you the best in your endeavours. I personally hope that you do get a second term, but that of course is in the hands of the President. But we're pleased, and you can see by the number of people who turned up, there's a huge amount of interest in what you're doing, and you have all our best wishes. Thank you.